Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dharma class at Crossover Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from May 30th, 2017. My Dharma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the wisdom of developing restraint. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So the wisdom of restraint. There is a popular phrase that shows that the modern view of the purpose of life for many is acquisition and a consumer-driven way of life. That phrase is, life is a banquet, don't leave the table hungry. This phrase is likely an adaptation of a quote from Aristotle, who lived approximately 150 years after the Buddha, who said, "It is best to rise from life as from a banquet, neither thirsty nor drunken." Of course, that's been adapted to our way of looking at the world. Notice how the adaptation to Aristotle's quote dismisses restraint in favor of consumption and continually seeking to satisfy the senses. Rephrasing the modern adaptation to reflect restraint might be, life is a banquet, take only what is necessary. Modern life encourages constant engagement with the world and in many subtle ways discourages restraint. Many today feel overwhelmed by the demands of life and the busyness of their lives. Often what is creating the busyness is a lack of restraint and a wrong view of what is realistically skillful and necessary to associate with. Solitude and disengagement are essential aspects of the Dhamma and are easily developed through proper restraint. It is mindful restraint at the sixth sense base that develops awakening or full human maturity. The six sense bases are five physical senses and interpretive thinking. In this way, the teachings on restraint directly relate to dependent origination in a very practical way. Anybody have any questions about that? If you do while I'm reading, I got my head down, just holler out.
Why is it at the six sense base, why is it that awakening there? Because it's prior to contact?
Yes, once we, now remember, I'm going to review dependent origination again. Remember that this, we're already in the process rooted in ignorance. So now that anything that comes through that view is simply reaffirming that ignorant view. And it's through our contact with the outside world that we do that, because we have now self-identified. Remember the different sutras where the Buddha talks about eye consciousness, nose consciousness, ear consciousness, etc., making a consciousness out of each sense or sense organ. And it's because that way, when we take something in through our eyes, we immediately evaluate it, whether we like it or we don't like it, or we're neutral, and that usually leads to immediate distraction. The same thing with our other senses. And that interpretation is going on through a consciousness that's rooted in ignorance. So it's at that point of contact that we continue confused and deluded thinking. It's an important question.
My question is that if you're not ignorant of the Four Noble Truths, then wouldn't the restraint happen way before the contact or the sixth sense base?
Boy, another good question. So, yes, but at that point, you won't be practicing restraint. You'll be living with restraint. So in the context, and in the context of the sutta, we need to be mindful of restraint because that isn't a quality of our life yet, a quality of our mindfulness. It's something we have to integrate. Again, that's what the Eightfold Path is for. But an awakened, fully mature human being does not attach or join with the world in any way. An awakened, fully mature human being is simply using the theme that we've been using a lot, is simply always in a process of becoming awakened and not contributing to their own confusion, delusion, and suffering. Is that clear to everyone? Mm-hmm. And it really points to what's occurring in this moment. Everything comes back to what am I doing in this moment to either achieve awakening or continue awakening or continue ignorance? Lorna?
What I wrestle with sometimes is, I know, and I understand what you've said about having restraint with your eyes, your ears, your aromas and smells and understand the teaching, but when you're off the cushion going back to your general life, I still don't always follow it because I think that my life, well, I'm not sufficiently awakened to be so peaceful at mind, with my mind, with nothing, without stimulating those senses. So I do wrestle with the fact of how much practice to do, but not make yourself unhappy, but practice restraint. Where is that happy medium? I mean, you can't make yourself...
Do you remember Goldilocks and the Three Bears?
Yes, I do.
Just the right amount. And it really is that way. And I know that's not a very satisfying answer. The Buddha taught a middle way between the extremes of constant sensory indulgence and complete asceticism. Mm-hmm. Early on in practice, to insist that I be perfectly well concentrated and perfectly mindful of the Eightfold Path 100% of the time is a form of asceticism at that point, because it hasn't developed yet. It's one of the reasons why forced long periods of meditation or forced silence and all that is a form of asceticism, because we're forcing ourselves to do something that we're not ready to. So you just said it, that you're not always able to engage in it, but you are able to engage in it much more than you ever used to be, which was not at all.
Yeah.
And that's the process that you are in of becoming awakening. And it is that process. It's enough to simply be mindful of it and to be the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, right effort, is the reminder that yes, we need to continue to deepen this practice. And you started out with saying off your cushion. That's the reason why there's an Eightfold Path and it's not just meditation. If it was really enough to just meditate and not be concerned about the other processes that are going on inside our conditioned mind, the Buddha would have taught that. He would have said, just go there and meditate and meditate and meditate and meditate and meditate, like some of the modern schools. Keep meditating and meditate, and eventually. But he never said that. In fact, there's nowhere that I've ever come across where the Buddha said to meditate for long periods of time. In fact, I've never come across anything where the Buddha said to meditate any length of time except within the framework of the Eightfold Path, meaning a sufficient amount. You know, so another great question.
Are you familiar with Helen and Scott Nearing?
Oh yeah, some of my.
So they were great homesteaders and promoters of that kind of lifestyle, and I heard them speak years and years ago, and one thing that I remember Helen saying was on Thanksgiving, they would choose to fast on Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she adopted the, the idea of take as little as you need, not as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they live their lives. And I was in college when I heard them speak, and Mary came to visit me at college, and we went to this this great event at UMass. Buckminster Fuller was there, Ralph Nader was there, the Nearings were there. It was like a mecca of great minds and contributors. And Mary remembers that, and when she was in charge of the food service at, was it Temple? Or was it MIT?
Drexel.
She brought that concept to the food service there, whether it was the student service or the conferences for the professors and visitors. But she would have these sayings all around to remind people not to take more than they needed.
Yeah.
You know,
and they would name it the tray.
Yeah.
Wow.
In the cafeteria.
It's such an, this part of this teaching, but it's such an important teaching. And that is so contrary to how we're influenced to live our lives, to get as much as we can, and to hold on to as much as we can, to pile it up in our houses and our sheds.
Sorry, Helen, did you say those were the Shakers? Was she a Shaker?
No. Helen and Scott Nearing.
Two great books, Living the Good Life, and the other one was so poignant, Living and Leaving the Good Life, about the end of his life.
Oh, I didn't read that
one. Oh, it's a great it's a great book. I probably still have it somewhere, too, if you can't find it. It's a great book.
Yeah.
Both of them influenced, both of the books in their lives influenced me a lot.
Because the Shakers would say the same thing. They have a thing that says, take as much as you want, but eat everything that you take. So, which means that makes you, well, sort of, maybe that is indulgent, but
it makes you
be mindful that what you take, you can't
Instead of, even on retreat, you know, I notice what's going on there because I watch, and almost everyone takes, they don't fill their bowls up like, you know, you mine at a banquet, or I mean at a buffet, you know, like the Golden Corral, people take a little, you know, they take enough for
what. They have these bowls that were like, they were so big, and you put what you knew you could eat, and it looked like just a little bit in the bottom of the bowl. And so you really had to be conscious of it, because if you filled one of the, they were like serving bowls.
Yeah. Food was good though, wasn't it? All right, let's get back to class. All right, so let me continue. So this leads to dependent origination. As restraint. Now relate what we're talking about in general tonight, restraint in relation to dependent origination. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. From name and form as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense basis. From the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact. From contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. So, in that 12-link chain, there's a quiz. In that 12-link chain of dependencies, where should we practice restraint? Where is it going to be most effective?
You said the six-sense base.
At every point?
You could say it, at every point. But it's at the six-sense base that we're noticing the process of craving and clinging.
Mm-hmm.
And again, something catches our eye. I want it, you know. Or a smell, you know. Mom just made a new apple pie. Man, I'm getting down there early. You know, craving and clinging. Or when I used to smoke and I'd smell somebody else's cigarette smoke, I got to have one. Craving and clinging. It's at that point, at when we start, and this is off our cushion too. When we're off our cushion and we're starting to self-identify with what's occurring in the world, it's at that point that we practice restraint. Now, if we don't have a measure of concentration, we can't do it. We don't even recognize that we're doing it. We're running on automatic. We're just grasping after anything or maintaining aversion to everything. And that's in a constant process of changing too. But as we deepen our concentration, we can recognize where we're grabbing for things, where we're establishing a self, where we're craving and clinging at that point of contact. That's where we begin to practice restraint.
But
Bonnie, you're right too, that it can be at any point. If we recognize that I'm stuck in an ignorant point of view and I'm starting to create a fabrication, an assumption, practice restraint. Morning.
So that grabbing that you mentioned in the Dharma is the opposite of restraint.
Mm. Exactly, yeah.
If you're not practicing restraint,
yep, and you could say that's the black and white of the Dhamma. You know, that's where the rubber hits the road. Listen to these phrases I'm using. It really comes down to, what am I doing right now? Am I grasping or am I at peace? And you can't be of two minds. You know, in the Christian theology, you say you can't worship two masters. You're either craving or you're at peace. When the Buddha described an awakened human being, he described their mind as calm. What's the opposite of calm? I got to have something. I need something. I need a distraction. I need something to fulfill me. I need something to maintain me. I need something to describe me in this moment, meaning I might need a new shirt or a new pair of pants or tickets for the ball game this weekend or anything to continue to establish myself. Isaiah.
And like, you don't need to answer this too personally, but ideally, like in life, practical things like being social or like buying a shirt, you know? And it doesn't need to be about like whether you do these things, but when you feel a certain way, like how do you know, like say you get happy about buying a shirt, right?
Yeah.
Would you recommend like stopping yourself from doing it? Or like, because then, you know, once, you know, you bought the shirt, then you're like, you know, you wear it a couple times and it doesn't make you so happy. Like, is that like...
Well, that's when you buy the shirt and the next day it doesn't make you happy anymore.
Yeah.
That's when you know you've created an identity or an attachment
to
it.
Where do you stop yourself there? Do you not buy the shirt, or do you try to make yourself not happy about it?
What a great question, Isaiah. And honestly, I'm not. Everybody knows here. I don't say things just to make people feel good, but it shows that you're developing an understanding of what this is all about. At that point, you don't have the perspective to even understand what's occurring. In other words, if you feel like buying a shirt, buy a shirt. It's developing the understanding of craving and clinging in a general way that at that point when it's time to buy a shirt, you will no longer have any attachment to the shirt. Now, that doesn't mean you'll look at the shirt and see and recognize that this is a shirt that fits me and... You know, it's not purple polka dots with elephants on it. It's an appropriate shirt to wear. So when I come to class, most of the day I'm sitting in front of the computer writing and I have, you know, maybe jeans and a t-shirt on, but I wouldn't come to class that way because I don't think it's respectful towards what I'm doing. So I put on a shirt that's relatively clean and a pair of pants that are relatively clean.
So if I get what you're saying that it is better or whatever, wherever that goes. To buy the shirt and not feel overjoyed about it, then do not buy the shirt, because that's kind of like copping out.
Yes, and buy the shirt because it's practical to wear clothes. I mean, really, and that doesn't mean that we shouldn't buy something that is appealing. But if we're creating an identity over it, and this gets pretty subtle, it takes concentration in the right framework. If you're looking at the shirt and saying, I'm going to look great in that shirt and the girls are going to love me, there's probably some eye making in there. But if it's simple practical matter of, we cannot walk around in this society without any clothes on. You know, you can, but there's going to come be consequences. And even at the Buddhist time, it was common, and still today in parts of India, it's common for people to not wear clothes. That's way that they practice their asceticism. Mm-hmm. Even during the Buddha's time, there were great groups of mendicants that walked around naked to prove that they weren't attached to anything of the body. Yes. The Buddha when he left his home, he gathered up some rags and he made a robe, not for any other reason except to protect his body from bugs, from the elements, etc. Because it was a practical thing to do. It was part of that middle way path, a practical way of living. So there is a practical way of living. Some people, when they come to this, think that, well, we should just go live in a cave and not worry about anything.
Yeah.
And that's okay if that's what you want to do. But most of us are going to live in the world. And if we're going to live in the world, it means that we need to do some practical things, like have a job so we can take care of ourselves. The Buddha said we need four things in the world. We need food, medicine, shelter, and clothing. Just the fact that we need those things doesn't mean we have to create an identity over it. In other words, we don't have to have the best clothes and the best food, the greatest doctor in the world, you know, and the biggest house. But we need those things.
A shirt might have been too necessary a thing for my question. That was like, thank you for answering that shirt one. But for all the things that make us happy, that aren't directly on the path to the divine, or, you know, whatever you're, you know, on the path toward, is there a certain way you should feel about those things? Like, if I came to class and everyone was like, Isaiah wasn't happy to see me, and I'm like, well, you know,
I see what you're saying. We're always happy to see you, by the way.
Right, no,
but again, it's a great question. If your happiness depends on everybody recognizing you when you walk in, Norm! then you're really looking for the. Oh, you probably don't know Cheers. That's a TV show from the 1920s. You're really getting the subtleties of it, because am I living in the world so that I'm noticed and that I have things and that other people notice that I have things? You're setting yourself for disappointment, aren't you? Because all those things that you're creating an identity over are prone to vanishing one way or another, either from decay or, you know, financial loss or whatever. Any there's a myriad of reasons why we can lose things and things change. Impermanence is the underlying experience of life in this world. Everything is impermanent. So why create? Lao Tzu said, if you understand the impermanence of all things, you'll let go of everything. Meaning, why create identities over these things? It doesn't mean that we don't have basic human needs that we should take care of. And it also doesn't mean we shouldn't have anything. It's okay to have things. Just don't create identities over it. The best example of that I can give is, we've all left our homes and the places we lived. And we all have stuff there. But in order to keep that stuff, we didn't have to bring it all with us. We didn't have to cling that much to it in order to maintain it. It's still there when we get back to it. But we don't have to create identities over the things that we have in our lives in order to be who we are. In fact, we're going to be much happier and much more at peace when we don't attach ourselves to objects, events, people, views, and ideas. Including the idea that a new shirt is going to make me happy. Or that I'm going to be recognized will make me happy. And think about it, just take that a little bit further. If I'm living my life because I need to be noticed in a certain way, I'm also setting myself up to be disappointed when I'm not noticed, aren't I? So why do it in the first place? It's not important. There's no significance to it. It's really a great question.
No, I'm just sitting here amazed at how young he is and how...
I know, it kills you, doesn't it?
That's such a huge key right there that unlocks happiness, because I found way too late in life that anything that causes happiness and its absence will cause unhappiness is not happiness.
Yep.
And that's amazing that he's so young and he has that kind of understanding.
It really is.
Yeah, it's like even taking, it's almost like seeking other people's approval and acceptance is a drug in itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can never satisfy it. Never, ever, ever. If you got a million people saying you're the most wonderful creature in the world, the next minute it's got to be a million and one or you're not going to be happy.
I tell my own kids, like the whole thing with the clothes or whatever it is, it could be anything. That it really defines what a need and what a want is. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's like really being honest with yourself over what it is, why you want it.
Yep. And the Buddha felt it was good to define it. We need food, shelter, medicine, and clothing. But we don't need all of it, you know?
So I have a subtle question. You need to buy a shirt. You choose a shirt that you like. That's okay, but needing other people to, oh, I love your shirt. Mm-hmm. I mean, we obviously pick, we make choices which indicate our preference. But to me, the difference is then going out and saying, oh, Ram, good to see you. How are you? Oh, I'm great too, but enough about me. What do you think of my shirt? You know? So I think is that the line is? Mm-hmm. That, I mean, we have choices. Pleasure's not a bad thing, but it's about being addicted to it or constantly
having. There's nothing wrong with it. While you were talking, I was thinking about that Madonna song, Vogue. You know, you don't have to Vogue it. You don't have to make sure. You know, it's a practical thing. And I wouldn't even say you don't need to take pleasure in exercising your preference. It's simply a preference. So the simpler we live our lives. Now think about how the Buddha left incredible wealth. He got a brand new set of clothes every day of his life. Studied with rubies and emeralds and all this stuff, you know, the finest material, whatever it was back then, silk, you know. And he left all that behind so he could So the only thing he wanted at that point was just a robe to keep him protected from the elements. He did that not as a rejection of what he lived previously. It was simply practical. So again, we live in a world where you can't walk. If you walked around in ratty robes, which anybody could do, that's going to have its own kind of conflict, won't it? And you'd probably do that to make a point, meaning to be eye-making in that. But just the practical matter of buying nice clothes because they fit and they look okay. Yeah, I would say that if you bought a purple polka-dotted shirt with pink elephants on it, you're probably doing it so that people notice that. And again, this all comes down to some pretty subtle levels of eye-making, but it's important to recognize that. At some point, it just doesn't matter. You know, and you don't even really think about the eye-making because you're beyond that. You go buy a shirt or a pair of pants or shoes or boots or anything else because it's practical to do.
And it's a bit of a process.
Oh, yeah.
You start out with, you know, more ego investment in your clothes. And as you recognize how much you put into it, you start to say, oh, do I need that much? No. And you start toning things down. Or, you know, you just...
That's right.
Live on what people give you sometimes, you know. It's, oh, yeah.
And you'll notice that you don't even have to create an identity over it. I remember you don't have to be Imelda Marcos with your shoes. Another reference you won't remember. Sorry, Isaiah.
In a closet with 5,000 shoes.
Yeah, she spent a lot of her country's wealth on atomic hands. You don't remember that either. A shoe store. The whole point we talk about. I got to get back to this. The whole point is, what are we doing? Is it eye making? Look at what you're doing. And recognize that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. But if you're feeling like you have to do it,
yeah,
you're setting yourself up, you're engaging in distraction at that moment, and you're setting yourself up for future disappointment, which is the whole point. Bonnie?
Yeah, I just keep thinking that there have been times in my life where I think I want something because it's going to make my life better, make me happy. And then when you get it, maybe it lasts for a minute, and then after a while, so now, like, if there's something, especially, you know, I think I want something, it's like, you know, because I know that I don't want to have it and then have to face that you really didn't want it.
Yeah.
So practicing the restraint, even in waiting, is it something that I will... help me to live my life to a highest good or something, you know, it's yeah. So I know, you know, like knowing that those things are not going to make my life any happier.
Yeah, you're incorporating restraint at the point that you should.
Mm-hmm. And no, ultimately, so I think that I,
excuse me.
You know,
you also hate to shop.
Well, and ultimately you realize, and the whole point of this, that there's nothing in the external world that we can acquire that's going to contribute in any way to our happiness.
Mm-hmm.
It's all an inside job, and even more than that's a little mystical, too mystical for me. It really is, what am I holding in mind in this moment? What am I holding in mind? Hopefully it's nothing that's self-referential. And I'm just simply present with life as life occurs. That is the reward. That's the whole point. And it doesn't mean you don't have anything. It simply means you're not attached to anything. It means that your calm and peaceful mind, your ongoing happiness, is not dependent on anything. What does that say about the origination of happiness? It's dependent on not attaching yourself to anything, any object, event, view, or idea. It means that your life does not need to be any different than it is as it's occurring. And again, it doesn't mean that you might find yourself in a position of incredible wealth. You just won't need it for your happiness. It also doesn't mean that you might find yourself occasionally in situations where you don't know where next month's rent's coming from. It doesn't mean you won't do anything about it, like get up and go to work the next day or find a job or anything or chop wood, but you won't lose your mind over it. You'll be able to stay present. You'll be much more effective in your life as your life unfolds.
I just had an interesting thought. It's like by the time you realize you're happy, It's impermanent. Yeah, it's already behind you.
It's already behind you.
So it's like you can only meet happiness right at that present, at that moment right there. And
free of the need for anything to be different. There was a time in my life when I was making good money and I made sure that I spent it quicker than I made it. And I bought a new car every year. And I got into it. This lasted for like 3 or 4 years maybe. And I remember the feeling every time I drove off the lot with that new car. What am I getting next year? I mean, I couldn't go a mile in that new car and enjoy it until I was distracted by the next year. What am I getting next year?
So if you're distracted, you miss it.
I did.
Right?
I did. I mean, that's not to say I didn't enjoy the car, but that was my thought process. And if I look at it, and we probably all do it the same way. As soon as we get to, Isaiah, you just said, as soon as you get something, you know, the next day, what's next?
It's like, you know, seeking something that thrills the mind and chills it.
Yeah. Yeah. And a self-referential ego self can never be satisfied. It always needs to continually be establishing itself in every object, event, view, and idea that occurs, including the next idea of what's next for me.
So say you live in a cave, right? Like a mystic, and it's all happening on the inside, right? And you're like, you got that down. But then, can you go out and like have a good conversation with someone? Or like, where do people
go? Well, you're going to sit up here. Because you know, wow. Yes, you will, as long as you're not attached to the identity of a cave dweller. And what I'm saying is that a calm and peaceful mind is an aspect of an awakened, fully mature human being. You'll be able to converse in a meaningful way with anyone. You're not detached from the world in any way, even though you may spend most of your time in a cave. Thomas Merton, who was a great Christian mystic, I may not have the years right, but I think he spent about 10 years in meditation. And he did it on top of a mountain. And the reason why he said he came off the mountain is he realized that what he had developed in his own mind was useless, in his words, was, unless I can take it into the marketplace. Meaning, what good is it to have an awakened mind if you can't relate to the world? And if you think about the Buddha, the person who started all this, Buddhism, I mean, he didn't awaken and then spend the rest of his life withdrawn from the world. He withdrew from the world so that he could awaken, and then he spent the next 45 years of his life completely engaged in the world moment by moment.
So there is an end in helping people that is not fleeting?
There's an end to helping people?
Like you're saying that these two people...
Oh!
Like, realized or ended up helping, or at least sharing what they had instead of giving it to themselves.
Yes, and that's it. That's an individual choice. So it doesn't mean that when you awaken that you need to spend the rest of your life teaching others how to do the same. Even the Buddha describes that there's four different types of people that awaken. And there's people that awaken and will teach people, and they have the ability to do it. There's people that will awaken and they will spend the rest of their lives withdrawn from the world. There's people that will awaken and teach in a very structured way, but not in the way that the Buddha did it. In other words, people will come to you. I can't think of the fourth person.
Maybe just by example.
That's, yes. So awakening doesn't compel you to do anything, if that's what your question is. But you will naturally be, whatever you decide to do, you will be present in the world in a much more meaningful way than is ever possible if you're not awakened. Yeah. So many of the people that the Buddha taught awakened, and they didn't get into teaching at all. You'll often hear me refer to the Buddha was at so-and-so at Jita's Grove, in Savatthi at Jita's Grove at Anathapindika's monastery. Anathapindika was a man the Buddha taught. He was a wealthy man at that point. He awakened, and he spent the rest of his life as a businessman, not as a teacher. But he also helped support the Buddha with his money. In fact, if it wasn't for Anathapindika, the Buddha wouldn't have the monastery that he had, that him and the monks and the nuns had, that protected them from the elements for many years too. So all that's a part of it.
And so just to make even farther, say you're driving home and you said, wonderful class, I was selfless, I helped people, you know? and like you find yourself smiling about it, you know? Is there something you tell yourself? Or do you just let that, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Do you let yourself like get sad on the next day when you don't have a class and you don't have the same external stimulation, even if it's like wonderful and from a great place, you know? Like,
yeah, I take myself to Ow Wow Cow and get some ice cream.
Do you?
I'm sorry to be flippant. Again, boy, you asked such a great question and a very personal question. So,
well, I'm sorry.
No. It's good that you asked. I don't evaluate the class whether it was good or bad as far as my teaching was concerned. In other words, did I do a good job or did I do a bad job? I'm very conscious of presenting the Buddhist teachings in as clear and direct way as I possibly can. I think that's important. And when I do that, I take great satisfaction in that. I also take great satisfaction in just a class that is well engaged with by everyone, you know. And there's times when I smile, when it just makes me feel good. There's nothing wrong with taking satisfaction out of what you're doing. But also the understanding is that even that satisfaction is fleeting. Even this is fleeting. Mm-hmm. There's a lot. I mean, what's it, Mike? I almost couldn't think of his name. Right? The owner.
Yes.
Michael. Yeah, I couldn't think of his name for a minute. He could decide tomorrow that he's got to sell the building. You know? Well, there's the end of Cross River Meditation Center. But yeah, I take great satisfaction. This is, when I think about it, I can't imagine a more meaningful life than to be able to do what I do. And, you know, I don't mean this in any way, but it's not because there's a lot of money attached to it. There isn't. It's not that there's a lot of fame attached to it. There isn't. It's in the moment that my life is incredibly meaningful. So, boy, yes, it's great. I want to hear what Isaiah's got to say.
you answer my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
This kid speaks to my heart. It's like, that was a perfect explanation of self-fulfillment and self-glorification.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's the difference
between them?
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't need to be the world's greatest meditation teacher to enjoy being a meditation teacher. There was a time when that wasn't true. You know, when I was in the construction business, even though I had to be the best guy in the construction business. You know, silly to create identities like that.
So, for me, and this is just sort of how I look at it, is it's a concentration of the skillful use of the Dhamma. So, if you're in a situation when you're questioning, am I making when I buy this shirt? Then you look at it with the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. With ignorance, you would look at it and it would catch on to the dependent origination loop, and you'd get caught up in giving it form and meaning where it doesn't need to have meaning. But if you look at it within the framework of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, that do I have a right view? Am I talking to myself with the right message? Is it right speech?
Yeah.
Is it right action? And you can just sort of go through the Eightfold Path and sort of check in with yourself on how am I skillfully using the Dhamma
yeah.
to move through life.
Yeah, that's it. That's incorporating the Eightfold Path as a framework for your life.
But it helps to answer questions along the way.
Oh, yeah.
Like when you're in an agitated state, and you may not know exactly where that agitation is coming from.
Yeah.
So you just sort of check in with yourself on the Eightfold Path and see,
yeah,
is it the view that I have of the situation? Is it having an unsettled mind? Is it, just sort of going through the whole checklist? Do I have the wrong view? Am I holding on to something within this moment? And On a good day, that helps you get through it. On a bad day, you may still end up having an agitated mind after you process it. But I just find that all very, very helpful.
Yeah, that's how you practice.
And to interrupt the dependent origination.
Yeah, the constant need for eye-making. And at the end of the day, if your mind is agitated, you're at peace with that less than peaceful mind state. Simply because it's impermanent and it's what occurred. And you learn from it. You know, you learn how you got there. Let me finish this.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. <we're
laughs>
I just took
a lesson in all this.
Yeah, I asked that question. Does anybody see? So as the fifth link in the 12-link chain of dependencies, the sixth sense base follows from the initial ignorance of Four Noble Truths. What this means is that the interpretation of contact at the senses is rooted in ignorance, and only in the sense that if we're creating identities over this, these things that are giving us pleasure or creating aversion, over creating an identity over that, that's rooted in ignorance, and that's what we should recognize. And that's where we should practice restraint. And we all talked about that. Even Isaiah, you brought up the point of practicing restraint at eye-making. You know, when I'm established. You're reading the book, aren't you? It's brilliant, right? No eye-making in that.
It's just a fact.
Just a fact. Any further assumptions made by contact can only further the confusion and deluded thinking that was initiated by those initial fabrications arising from ignorance. Remember, fabrications is the condition that follows from or is required, is dependent on ignorance to develop. And then everything follows from those assumptions rooted in ignorance. In other words, whatever follows from ignorance will be tainted by the fabrications or conditioned thinking initiated from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It is imperative to recognize the ongoing process of using sensory stimulus to attempt to continue to establish a permanent self through discursive self-referential thinking. Rather than use sensory stimulus to continue confusion, delusion, and ongoing unsatisfactory experiences, recognizing this process of eye-making or selfing develops the ability to be mindfully present with what is occurring, rather than interpret life unfolding from a view rooted in initial ignorance. So this article, I have four suttas that I cited, but we've had such an enlightening discussion, I'm only going to cite one, and that's the Arapahani Sutta, or the Sutta on Not Losing the Way. The Buddha teaches those gathered, having developed four qualities, a Dhamma practitioner cannot lose the way and is free of clinging to views when one has fully integrated the Eightfold Path. When they have, they are established in virtue. They guard the sixth sense base. They know moderation in eating, and they are devoted to mindfulness. And how does one establish virtue? They are continually mindful of the precepts and the various factors of the Eightfold Path. They understand even the slightest unskillful actions. And how does one guard the sixth sense base? On seeing form, they do not grasp at fabrication that would further greed and distraction. They practice restraint at the eye. Furthermore, on hearing a sound, they practice restraint at the ear. On smelling an aroma, they practice restraint at the nose. On tasting a flavor, they practice restraint at the tongue. On feeling a tactile sensation, they practice restraint at the body. On cognizing an idea, they practice restraint at the intellect. They do not grasp at fabrications. Notice the incredible practicality of this. There's nothing mystical or esoteric. It's right at that point of contact when we start creating craving and clinging that the Buddha says that's where you apply restraint. This is how one guards the doors to the sixth sense base. And how does one establish moderation in eating? They understand nourishment skillfully. They do not eat for entertainment or distraction. They do not eat for intoxication. They do not eat to grow large. I always like that line. Or for beautification. They eat simply for the survival of the body so that the integrated life can be lived. We can't awaken. Now remember, during the, you might not, you know, have heard this, Isaiah. Towards the end of the Buddha's process of awakening, he wandered around northern India for 6 years, and towards the end of that year, that time, he was practicing these very severe ascetic practices, so much so that it said that he ate one bean a day or a grain of rice, and he became a very, very emaciated, The Buddha tells that he could feel his spine through his belly. He was so skinny. And at the end of that, he passed out and rolled into a river and almost drowned. And it was at that point that he developed an understanding of the middle way, that it wasn't this extreme asceticism and complete self-denial. He understood the need to eat, but only to take care of the body so that we can develop awakening. That's why we're here. It's the most important point of why we're alive. They abandon craving for food and for mindless eating. And how does one establish mindfulness as a quality? Whether resting, sitting, or moving about, they cleanse their mind of anything that is a distraction. This is how one establishes mindfulness. Of course, he's teaching people who already are developing the path and they're meditating, they're deepening concentration. Having established these four qualities, this Dhamma practice will not lose the Eightfold Path. Established in virtue, restrained with a sixth sense base. Established in moderate eating, established in mindfulness. Forthright and inspired, the qualities for unbinding develop. Delighting in refined mindfulness. Think about that. Rather than delighting in what we can get and what the next moment might bring or what I can avoid, I've developed a quality of mind that I can delight in that alone. That's something we can always take with this, isn't it? The quality of our mind. Knowing the danger of mindlessness, they stay true to the Eightfold Path and remain free of deluded views. Going right back to the beginning of dependent origination, deluded views, another word for that would be ignorance of Four Noble Truths. There's three more suttas in there, but I think we've gone far enough with that tonight, right? So any questions about this sutta? Or what we're talking about? We've had a pretty good discussion. So I'd just like to go around the room then and just check in with everybody, start with Ron. Good to see you tonight, my friend.
Practice has been good, steady. But I see large differences in my meditation, from being quite focused to sometimes blowing a whole 20 minutes to some thought that comes in and goes. And it doesn't seem to have any cause. It just, from one day to the next, it's this way or it's that way. And I'm starting to get to be at peace with that too.
Good, yeah.
Not having to have it this way.
Thank you. And you recognize what's most important is that you meditate, not what occurs during meditation. And even those times when you have that one thought and it keeps you going for most of the meditation, you're still deepening your concentration every time you come back to the sensation of breathing. It's just that way.
Thank you. Just the recognition that these things, that meditation is many different things.
Yeah. Thank you. Helen, good to see you.
Good to see you too, John. My meditation was a little interrupted this weekend. I was traveling a lot. But my sense of calm is good.
Yeah. Isn't that nice? It's worth the price of admission, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you. Isaiah, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Sometimes when I'm meditating, I get feelings that are uncomfortable, and so it doesn't really work for me to try not to think of them, so sometimes just sit in a puddle.
And come back to your breathing?
No, I just try to feel them. Well, and while breathing.
Yeah.
So maybe that's not totally the best way, but I find that they become less scary, if I experience them.
Yeah.
Not in a chronological way, but as a whole, you know.
Yeah. No, and that again, whatever comes up in meditation, I even say it, stay with it for a moment or two or three, come back to the sensation of breathing. Have you gotten to the chapter on the four foundations of mindfulness?
No.
Okay, so that will address what you're talking about right now, and then we could talk about that too. But in that, the Buddha teaches mindfulness in two applications. One is the four foundations of mindfulness, which is really mostly an instruction on what occurs during meditation. So we become mindful of the sensation of breathing, and then feelings may arise. We recognize that, come back to the sensation of breathing. Thoughts may arise that have been driven by those feelings, and sometimes that's reversed. It might be thoughts that seem to give rise to a feeling. We simply recognize it, come back to the sensation of breathing. And ultimately what we recognize, and it's the instruction I give at the last 5 minutes of meditation, to notice the quality of your mind, that's that fourth foundation of mindfulness. To simply notice what that process of feelings driving thoughts or thoughts driving feelings, how they affect the quality of your mind. Good, bad, indifferent, it doesn't matter, just to notice it. And that seems like what you're describing, that you just stay with it, you know, just what's occurring. Good for you. Great questions today. Bonnie, good to see you.
I'm just working on just that, you know, especially with the restraint of and being aware. Sometimes it's after, and I can look back and say, maybe I could have had half as much. So it just has been able to sit back and choose how I respond to. I've noticed whether it's with people I work with or people I have to interact with, which is really nice. I mean, I still have fabrications going on in my head maybe, but I can step back.
Yeah, so it's
good.
Yeah. The essence of restraint.
Just keep moving forward.
Yeah. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see everyone. It's good to be here. I've gotten a little off track with my meditation lately, and I'm feeling the results. So my goal is to just get back on the cushion.
Yeah. An aspect of right effort, too. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you.
Good to be here. Just like to flip back a couple of classes and say that I enjoyed the becoming. I think I've got into becoming and even got excited a bit about the becoming. I feel more aware of it and the choices we have from becoming. And we were chatting once and you said that you can slip becoming into any of the steps of the dependent origination. From the Four Noble Truths you have the choice of becoming more enlightened or whatever the fabrications, I think it is, of the Four Noble Truths. And just looking, becoming into dependent origination like that, it makes you realize that, you know, you have the choice all the time in everything. And that was very enlightening for me to see dependent origination like that. I know you've always said in the past that you can break the chain of, you know, the chain of links. But to me, that's always been a little bit vague. I've never kind of really focused on anything. But actually putting the word in, becoming, in each line, I think is been helpful.
Yeah.
I think I'm holding my own with my practice. I'm recognizing one or two things that I'm doing off my cushion and when I'm not being mindful. Have let fabrications just let run right sometimes in the mind and become unhappy. But that's all learning the Dharma, learning the teachings, being more insightful to the teachings, etc. It's just, I have been on the path in that sense. And, I can identify to what Ron said about sitting for 20 minutes and thinking at the end, oh, I suppose we've meditated. I've done that a few times too. That's all. I'm on the path. I'm working on it. Just quietly working on it.
And succeeding too, it sounds like. Noticing the arising and the passing away. Mm-hmm. Frank, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here tonight. It's a good class, good topic. My meditation is good. I notice more the quality of mind now when I meditate. And in the morning, it's always more peaceful and more agitated in the afternoon. And I just chalk that up to having a lot of experiences from the time I sit in the morning to the time I sit in the afternoon, interacting with a lot of people, chaotic environment. So it's being comfortable with that distracted mind frame. While I'm meditating, I'm noticing that I have so many more thoughts. I mean, dozens and dozens of thoughts in, you know, just 5-10 minutes of meditating. And it's a lot of recognizing and returning to the breath for me. It's almost exhausting until I kind of let go of that whole recognizing and returning and just letting it be. And I know I've probably heard this a lot in the last year and a half, but it's something that I felt like I heard for the first time over the weekend. I spent a lot of time by myself relating to the five clinging aggregates and dependent origination. I get really confused when I'm trying to see where I'm at on that link, whether name and form, or am I in the mental fabrication and assumption part of it, or have I already passed that, and am I now on to clinging and maintaining? And then I heard, almost for the first time, it's enough to just know that ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, that's enough to understand it. And that the vehicle of what's happening is the five clinging aggregates.
Yep.
So it's like I felt like I heard that for the first time in my life. And I was like, oh, wow, that was easy to...
yeah, once you get it.
You know, and it's interesting that today was on the tonight was on the restraint because I had an experience Sunday night. I was invited to a birthday party for a friend at a restaurant. All you can eat crab legs. And I sat at a table with 12 people and I was in awe for 3 hours. These people didn't pick their head up the plate eating snow crabs. And I completely refrained from even joining in. I just said, I'll have a bowl of steamed clams. And then later on, I was there for 3 hours. I started to get hungry again and I had a brisket sandwich. And it wasn't that it disgusts me, because I have definitely indulged in food before, you know, I do. But it was how the continuity of them not even noticing what was going on that was like continual, perpetuating. And there was like 3 waiters and waitresses running back and forth like crazy to this mass of people eating crab legs and there's shells all over the floor. And I'm just like, oh, wow. I'm like, I felt like I didn't belong there, you know, but I felt comfortable enough to just kind of notice what was happening and be a part of the celebration, but not be a part of the savage eating.
That's watch the show.
Yeah, it was entertaining. And there was a rock band playing really loud, off-key music that was pounding in my head. It was kind of interesting, but... I had fun.
Yeah, and you're able to maintain a measure of mindfulness and all that sea of distraction. You know, and boy, it was really geared that way too. How much distraction? The endless bowl of crab legs wasn't enough distraction. You needed a band going behind it too.
It was craziness.
Yeah, it is.
It was, you know, like that. It was like felt like I was seeing that for the first time in my life. Like really seeing what was going on. Yeah.
And that the recognition that the five clinging aggregates simply describe the personal experience of suffering is so important. And it just takes time. It takes continued effort. And then, you know, the veil lifts and you see it.
And it's interesting that you talk about those four forget what you call it, ways the Buddha said you can either awaken and then go in solitude, or you can awaken and teach, or you can awaken and lead by example, or whatever. And I think right now I just fall into the just being.
Yeah.
And not feeling like I have to. I felt comfortable enough just kind of experiencing that release from that, and I didn't need to do anything other than just be there.
There's no value placed on any of those either. If you think about if you would apply value to the one that goes out and teach, isn't that eye making? The point of the Dhamma is to awaken. What you do with it is what you do with it. You know, and again, the Buddha taught. Most of the people that the Buddha taught awakened. Not every one of those went out and taught either. You know, they were just content to do what they were doing.
I just had that fleeting recognition of what we were talking about, happiness. Like, by the time you realize you're happy, it's like already passed. I just realized that I was in that moment, and I didn't need to tell the band to stop playing and to tell these people to stop eating. And it was just okay. I didn't have to change it.
Yeah,
so
it is.
That was really good for me.
Isn't that?
I would have taken the tambourine and slammed it over that dude's head.
Being at peace with life as life occurs. Even a scene like that, it's just what's occurring. That's the reward. That's worth the price of admission. Great class. Any other questions about restraint? There's three more suttas that are cited in this article if you want to. Read. I was just thinking maybe I'll just get to them next week. I'll see. Maybe we'll just revisit this next week and I'll get to the other suttas. Oh, there it is. That's what we'll do. Okay. So we'll finish this next Tuesday. A few announcements. The link is in the email and it's on the website. The first annual Cross River Meditation Sangha picnic is
Square Dance.
July 15th. Rain date the 16th at Morris Place, just over the river. A lot of property with a nice pool. So bring your family, friends, pets, dogs, cats. I think I said horses, goats, and potbelly pigs are all welcome. There's a list of the website of what July 15th.
What day of the week?
Saturday. Rain date the 16th. Starts at 1. All the info is on the website and linked on in the emails too. So, our next retreat is October. It's coming up quick. So if you're coming, and I hope you are, register as soon as you can. It helps my logistics. And we'll finish with the Metta Sutta, the Buddha's words on Metta.
For the fall retreat, do you want us to pay up front now, or do you just need to know who's interested in coming?
It's a good question. It's best for me to know who's interested in coming, and I do have financial responsibilities that I have to meet with Juan. So,
like a deposit or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
is that right away?
It's usually 4 months out as the first payment. So I guess to answer your question, if you can pay when you register, it's best for me.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't and you just want to make sure that a room is put aside, just let me know. It's going to be nice up there.
It's
going to
be gorgeous. What is that, the first or second weekend in October?
The third, no, October 19th to the 22nd.
So it should be peak.
Yeah. Yeah. We were up there earlier once or twice and it was nice, but it wasn't peak yet. So.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talks tonight. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Is that shut off?
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.